Good afternoon, everyone. I am your host, Curtis Weed, joined with the ever-amazing Ryan Lindsay. How are you doing, Ryan?
Not too bad, mate. I'm ever-amazing as always.
Well, I appreciate you. Appreciate you coming in today. It's Australia Day, but we've got a pretty special guest, Jim Zupkovich. I'll do a little intro about him, and we'll get chatting with Jim. So, Jim Zupkovich, who currently writes the critically acclaimed Image comic series Skull Kickers, may spend 80 hours a week developing and promoting his series, but still manages to put in at least another 80 hours a week as one of the top dogs at New York Studios. And while he's at it, finds time to start a webcomic for Pulp Fiction Miracle. Jim, we are really happy to have you on the show. How are you doing today, buddy?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me, guys. It's great. I'm super excited about it. And I've been listening to the process for a while now, so I'm eager to dig in and be a part of it.
Well, I think it's going to be – we'll have an interesting conversation because you've come into comics from a variety of different backgrounds. You're also not just a writer. You're also an illustrator yourself. So we'll have lots of really interesting things to talk about today. Awesome. Why don't we just start off right off the bat? Where did your interest in writing begin?
I mean, I've always been kind of a storyteller. I know that sounds kind of corny, but it's true. Big, crazy, voracious reader. And then when I was a kid, I would always creative writing projects or anything writing related or storytelling related has always been my bag. I was a big tabletop Dungeons and Dragons nerd growing up, and so the idea of creating stories and in real time or coming up with stuff on the fly was always something that I had a big love of. I've also been a big crazy fan of everything from stand-up comedians to things like that. So that anecdotal quality of storytelling has always been something that I've been fascinated by and totally into. And then the ability to, comics are such a wonderful medium for that, where you can collaborate with other people or you can create them on your own. And it's all just sort of grown organically out of that. I was really convinced that I was going to be, more focused on the art end of it, because I thought that was something, it seemed more tangible that I could wrap my head around actually being able to do in terms of career stuff. But just over the last, few years, the actual writing end of it's become more and more important and something that I've been finding just more and more valuable as a whole. It's been wonderful. And so, here I am. Now I'm doing, my own Image comic series. I've got a few writing credits under my belt that I've done for, other clients and things like that. And I'm pumped about collaborating more in the future.
That's really interesting, Jim. I find there seem to be a lot of writers at the moment that are D&D nerds and very old school about it. And I like the fact that when you mention that, whenever I think of D&D, and I'm not a big D&D person myself, but I think of this sort of expansive scope of sort of world building and this epic scale of everything. And then you also mentioned liking this sort of anecdotal type writing, be it stand-up comics or just telling stories in general. It sounds to me like those two things would mesh pretty perfectly with comics, because with comics, as a lot of people say, you don't have that budget. And with Skull Kickers, you take advantage of it. You can create this fantastically wide world, and you can also sneak in little almost like vignettes within issues. Is that one reason that you pursued comics instead of writing fantasy novels or
screenplays? I just think there's I've always been really visual. Like, my background's in art, specifically in animation, and comics and animation seem to have a lot of good crossover, right from the start, whether you're talking about super classical comic strips like Little Nemo by Winsor McCay, which has got a very cinematic quality, or there's always been a lot of crossover between animation and comics, just in terms of art, in terms of style, in terms of approach, especially the types of styles that I really love. And so it just seemed like a natural marriage of it. There's always been a bit of a visual quality to the types of stories that I was telling. And, if you don't have the budget for animation, not that I'm trying to, comics are their own medium, and I think it's really important to keep that in mind. But there is that visual cinematic quality at times, and I think comics are a really great marriage of the visual components and the written components combined. So.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And you say you've got a bit of an art background. So when you write, do you really structure your pages thinking about how you want them to see them? Does it give you sort of the hot tip to be able to be more prescriptive for your artists, or do you still leave it?
I'm really visual. I'm also really pretty specific. I write full script, and I write pretty extensively about what's happening on the page visually. I want to paint a picture in the artist's mind that I'm collaborating with and get across the structural components or the main things that it should be happening within the page. And so I'm describing things very visually. Sometimes I'll be quite specific about structures, but it sounds weird, but I'm describing also why, like what effect I want the panels to have. It's always a very visual kind of a process for me. When I'm writing, I'm, you know, without trying to sound too corny, it's like I'm closing my eyes and I'm sort of imagining it playing out. But one of the most amazing things is that when I get the art back, I can see elements of what I've described in there, but there's always something more. There's always a layer of collaboration that's very exciting, where you're getting new elements being brought to the table visually, or you're getting also what the actual artist is envisioning based on what I'm saying. So, I look at stuff and I see elements of exactly what I wrote, but then I see more, I see different approaches, and it gets me really excited to collaborate in that way and to have at each stage it being plussed, you know, something being added to the mix.
Do you ever find that? Oh, go ahead, Ryan.
I was just going to say, sorry, Kurt. I think that's one big reason why I like having guests on the podcast, is because the information that disseminates to the public about script writing, I mean, Warren Ellis came out recently and spoke about it being like this love letter to the artist to win them over, but to also give them an idea. Some people have come out and said, if you're writing full script, you're not collaborating. You're basically making somebody work as a sweatshop under you. Some people are advocating going back to the Marvel style so that you've got this more freeform collaboration. And I think it's interesting to see how all the different pros are doing this, because, I mean, obviously there's no one way to script, but you have to find out what works between you and the artist. Do you find that's a real teething process?
I think you also learn to play to the strengths of the artist. You know, writing full script is not meant to be like a straitjacket for the artist that they feel like they can't add anything to it. If anything, I'm sort of saying, here's all this stuff that's going on in my mind. And it is, you know, Warren Ellis's description in that post is phenomenal, where he's describing it like a love letter. There's definitely elements where I feel like a cheerleader, where I'm not only writing the actual elements that are happening on the page, but I'm also saying, hey man, this is the big moment we've been building up for. Let's rock it. Let's, you know, get this scene out and really blow people away. Probably one of the weirdest things for me, and it took me a while to get into the groove, was Skull Kickers is an action comedy, with an emphasis on violent comedy, and describing a joke in a script and saying this is why it's going to be funny is one of the weirdest things you can do, because you're basically, it's not funny in the script. Like in the script, it's methodical in nature, but I'm describing to Edwin, the penciler, this is why it's going to be funny. The contrast between what's being said and what's being shown, or the systematic, rat-a-tat-tat kind of approach of these panels showing things degrading in terms of this situation, or the contrast between what happened when they did this last time and what's happening this time because they're jerks, you know, or whatever. Like, I'm literally breaking down in this very technical way why it's funny. And it's weird because, you know, at first I think I was really worried that I was over-explaining. But then when it comes out in the drawings and it's really clear and it is funny and the readers like it, you know, the result, that's the important part. You know, but there's a weird quality to it where you have to go through and be technical about a joke. It has to, in the final reading, it has to be effortless and come across like it's, oh yeah, we just shoot this from the hip, no big deal. But in the scripting phase, it's actually quite technical, and that's something that it's hard to explain to people. It's hard to describe when it says I'm gonna make being funny really boring in this script, but I know how it's gonna come across in the final, and I think with every issue I've gotten more confident about that process, you know. So
do you find that any of those times when you set up a joke and then you think it's really good when you're writing it, even while you're breaking it down in that painstaking way, when it gets to the page and you just look at it, has it ever been a just complete fail? Or do you find your jokes always at least resonate a little bit?
I think the toughest part for me is, I don't want to sound cocky, like, oh yeah, it's always perfectly funny. Like, obviously, this, you know, humor is subjective, and some people are going to find some things funnier than others. There's been little throwaway stuff that I thought was, oh yeah, that's mildly amusing. And people have told me that was the best part in the issue. And I'm like, oh wow, crap, okay, that's cool. The toughest thing for me is breaking down a joke, writing the joke in this technical way, getting the roughs, getting the line art, getting the inks, getting the colors, getting the letters, it's no longer funny. I mean, I know this gag inside out. I knew it the minute I wrote it, and looking at it, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 times, and then when the issue comes out, and to a new reader, it's, you know, it's spontaneous and it's fun, and they remind me of why I thought it was going to be fun in the first place, because to me, it's now old hat. I mean, between the solicitation process and release and production, you're talking 4 or 5 months, and someone's like, I mean, that's the new thing to them. That's the new issue, right? But to me, right, that's 5, 6 months old, and I'm like, oh, I'm glad you're finding that old thing funny. You know what I mean? Like, I know that sounds really cocky, but
I've evolved since then. You know, yeah. Just change the topic.
Like, all I want to say is, oh, you think that's good? Just wait. You know, just wait. Yeah. I got stuff lining up. You know, and that's a weird thing for me is feeling that process of by the time I'm sending it off to press, it's the old thing. I got to deal with the new thing. You know, in my mind, I'm past that. It's awesome. Yeah. I'm glad you're reading it. I'm glad you're enjoying it. But man, what I'm digging into right now is the new thing. And yeah, it's kind of a weird place to be on that front. There was one point where I sat Edwin down. He came up for the Toronto Fan Expo in August. And I basically sat down with him over a meal and just sort of like, verbal diarrhea, just went nuts and told him a whole bunch of upcoming stuff that was happening. And the blank look on his face by the end, where he's like, I can't believe you're thinking of all this crap. This is crazy. That sounds awesome. I'm not even going to remember half the things you just said. And I was just like, oh yeah, I guess I should probably, you know, calm down. It's going to be great. That's all you need to know. We're going to have fun. It's going to be great.
Well, we've kind of been mentioning Skullkickers. Why don't you, for anybody who, you know, hasn't heard of your comic yet, why don't you tell them what Skullkickers is about?
Okay. So, Curtis, you must have heard this pitch 100 times. Okay. So, Skullkickers is essentially a buddy cop movie meets Conan the Barbarian. So it's about two monster mashing mercenaries who are on this endless hunt for fame and fortune. And all they do is get into trouble and, it's essentially all the crazy classic fantasy tropes, but done with this sarcastic, over-the-top edge. And we're going to do the sort of heroes of destiny, but we're going to kind of sarcastically poke it in the eye.
Nice.
Yeah, that's what we're rolling. And if you like movies like Army of Darkness, or if you like Hellboy or stuff like that, then you will almost certainly enjoy Skullkickers.
Have you found that, like, you know, I've heard you give that pitch. Do you find that kind of tagline that you give at the buddy cop movie meets Conan, does it actually interest people, or do you have to kind of keep going to sell more?
This sounds really weird. Like, everyone's going to think I'm so technical about stuff, but here's the thing. Like, that pitch has been refined over, you know, I did 14 conventions in 2011. And so at each show, I'm pitching that thing, you know, 100 times. And so you just say it and you say it and you say it. What rolls off the tongue? What works? So it's almost a 3-stage pitch. This is – Edwin actually joked about this. He said, if you get to stage 3, we've pretty much got a sale. So it's like stage 1 is buddy cop movie meets Conan. And when I say that at a con, at a convention, everyone knows those elements. They know what Conan the Barbarian is. You know, generally speaking, they're not going to be turned off by it. If they're flipping through the book or they're at my table, there's at least some vague interest in the art or in fantasy or in something. So I say that line and I'll usually get a smile or a chuckle. If I get a chuckle or if they reach down and start looking through, they're interested. I've got them in a place where I can send upsell them to stage 2, which is, you know, if you like Army of Darkness or movies like that, you'll almost certainly love this. Well, I, you know, without trying to sound too cocky, it's rare that someone's at a convention for wonderful nerdly things and they hate, you know, yeah, Army of Darkness, screw that movie. That movie, you know, like, this movie is a cult classic and it's fun. And what I'm saying is, if you find that thing funny, you'll find this funny. So it's pretty rare that someone goes, A, I hate Army of Darkness, or B, what is Army of Darkness? And even if they say, oh yeah, that movie's awesome, they're not going to go, well, obviously I don't want to look at your book. You know, like, it's, well, I think that movie's awesome. Well, this is like that, only different. Oh, well, I'll at least flip through it, right? And if they're on that, then usually what I'm able to do is the 3rd stage of the pitch is, you know, we're part of Image's Value Price Trade paperback program. So the first trade, full color, 140 pages, is $10, which is cheaper than a manga.
Nice.
And then it's just sort of like, well, you'd be crazy not to try it for $10. And then if they're even remotely not gone at that point, then I'll go, and hey, I'll sign it for you too, so you get it autographed, no charge. But boom, boom, you know, $10, right? Nice. I know that sounds weird to say no charge, but like to an average person, if they're not a comic book fan, some of them think that autographs, you know, you have to pay for. If they're there at a convention and they know Captain Kirk's signature is $50 or whatever. So when I say I'm going to sign this thing no charge, sure, I'm nobody. But to your average schmo, right, who doesn't know anything about comic conventions, they sort of go, oh, and it's a free autograph. It's only $10. Well, yeah. Okay, cool, man. You seem like a nice guy, and that's a lot of fun, and it sounds fun, and the art looks great, and, you know. So you just sort of slowly pushing them towards inevitability, which should be, you know, you got to spend this money here right now. So.
Yeah. Well, why don't you tell us a bit about the origin of the series, like how it came together?
It's a really weird the way it came about. It wasn't actually something – this isn't a story that I've had – nurtured since I was a child or anything like that. I know a lot of comic book creators, they say, well, this is, you know, the book they've always wanted to write or whatever. It came about in a really kind of organic way. So Chris Stevens, he was the original artist on we did two short stories together of what eventually became Skull Kickers. So he was approached by Joe Keating. Do you know Joe?
Yeah.
Yeah, Joe's awesome, right? He's writing Glory now, and he's got his new book, Hell Yeah, coming out through Image. So he was one of the editors on Pop Gun, which is Image's sort of like showcase for new talent anthology. And it's won a bunch of awards, and it's a really cool package. So they approached Chris Stevens, this amazing artist that I've worked with in the past, about contributing a story to it. And I'm managing projects over at the Udon Studio, and Chris was working for us. And so he said, well, you know, is it okay if I do this? You know, as long as I don't miss my other deadlines and stuff, is it okay if I do this? I'm like, yeah, man, you know, fill your boots, do a story, have fun with it. It'll be cool. And so he was under the impression that they were going to give him a script or something. And so he goes back and says, yeah, man, just send me a script and I'll draw it or whatever. And they were like, no, we want you to do a story, your own story. So he calls me back up and he goes, oh, my God, they want me to do a story. I don't have any stories. I'm an artist. I draw stuff. Why do they want me to do a story? I'm like, dude, this is going to be great. You can do whatever you want. And he's like, yeah, I guess so, but I don't know what I want to do. So we chatted back and forth, and he wanted to do something fantasy, but not like highfalutin kind of, you know, classic fantasy, more irreverent and ridiculous. And so we just jammed out some ideas, and eventually I said, you should just do, you know, guys killing monsters, being violent and being ridiculous and whatever, and just sort of jammed a couple ideas, and we were laughing on the phone, and he said, yeah, that sounds really awesome, cool, man. And he went off on his way, and I figured he was going to do the story. And then I think maybe the next day or 2 days later, he calls me up and he goes, it was funnier when you said it on the phone. Like, I tried to script it out and it's not working properly. Do you just want to write this thing and then I'll draw it and that'll be cool? I said, great, no problem. So I wrote out a 10-page story, which was in Pop Gun Volume 2, and it was called Two Copper Pieces. And it was a lot of fun. Joe Keating and the other guys on the Pop Gun loved it. And Eric Larson, who was actually head publisher at Image at that time, really liked it and sent us a complimentary email about it. And then they asked us if we wanted to do another one for Pop Gun Volume 3. And I said, sure. And Chris was really busy with his schedule at that point. So he's like, I don't know if I can – I can't do 10 pages. I don't think I can do another story. So I said, we can do a joke in 3 pages. Give me 3 pages. And he's like, you can't do a story in 3 pages. I said, watch me. So I wrote this little gag story in 3 pages, and he really liked it, and he did it up again. And then Larson basically said to us, he goes, this is really good stuff. If you guys pitched a miniseries or whatever, you know, I'd probably greenlight it, you know, to do a full series in Image. So that was really cool. That was just an awesome feeling, and it felt good. And I realized that, you know, I could tell more stories with these idiots killing stuff and kind of scratch this itch I have of all my love of sword and sorcery and stuff like that. So I started jamming bigger ideas and coming up with kind of this rambling, crazed quest concept and how we could tie it together and kind of make it expandable. But you know, if we had to keep it to just one miniseries, here's how I'd do it. And pitched the idea, and Larson gave it the thumbs up, and we were off and running. except Chris's schedule got all screwed up, and then his finances got all screwed up, and the next thing I knew, he wasn't going to be able to do the art. And so we just mothballed the thing. I basically had the full concept for the first five issues done. I had the finished first script. We had the green light from Image, and we shelved it. I would go to conventions, and I would see Larson every so often. He'd say, "Are we going to do that Monster Killer book?" And I said, I don't know. He's like, "Cause it'd be cool. I'd love to do it." I'm like, "Me too," you know. And it just sort of died on the vine. And then the weirdest thing happened. It was almost 2 years later. So I mean, Skullkickers has sort of been in existence for a while, but it was just sort of mothballed. I was at the Udon Studio. I manage projects. I put together art teams for what's called creative services. So video game concept art that the studio's done for various clients like Capcom and Konami. We're currently doing some project work for Namco. I manage projects that we've done for movie stuff like Legendary Pictures. We've done a bunch of artwork for, or other movie properties. And so we get portfolios all the time from artists. Even though the studio actually tells people we're not hiring, we still get approached by all sorts of people. And without trying to sound mean, you know, most of those portfolios are they're pretty awful. And so I see a lot of submissions, and most of them just sort of, they get a generic letter back, and that's that. And I got an email from this kid in New York who was in his last year of art school. And his portfolio was really good. It was really solid. And he had really good storytelling chops, and his comics looked good. And, I had some small critiques, but for a student, you know, he was 21. I thought, holy crap, this guy's totally got it. Like, he's got the stuff. He's just, you know, needs a little bit more practice, and he'll be doing pro quality stuff, no problem. But the studio wasn't looking for anyone still. So I thought, you know, I don't want to totally discourage this kid with a generic sorry email. So I sent him a personalized email, and I said, "Hey, you know, buddy, you got great stuff. Here's what I like. Here's the couple things I'd change. But you're there. Like, just keep going. Even though I'm not going to be able to get you a job right now, like, don't stop because you've got the stuff." And he emailed me right back, and we started up a conversation. And one of the critiques I have for him, which is a pretty classic thing I see when I look at portfolios, is he wasn't leaving enough room for dialogue. So when you look at a finished comic page and it's got all the sound effects and the dialogue in there, you know, it's a pretty tight package. And so I think a lot of artists, when they're putting together their portfolio pages that don't have any sound effects or dialogue on them, they think they've got to be that dense. But the reality is, if you ever get a chance and you look at original artwork that's for sale at conventions, there's a lot of open space there. You know, if you've got a writer who's writing a lot of dialogue, that you need to leave lead room above characters' heads, and you need to have space for all that dialogue. So I said to Edwin, I said, "Look, you know, you got to leave more room for dialogue. Are you working from a script?" And he said, "No, I'm just doing these scenes out of my head. There's no dialogue or anything." And I said, "Well, if you show this to an editor, they're gonna crucify you for not having enough space for dialogue." And he said, "Well, you know, do you have a script you can send me I can work from?" And I said, "Well, we've got, you know," he said, "Can you give me a Street Fighter script?" Because the Udon Studio is known for all their Street Fighter comics. And I said, "Well, all the Street Fighter stuff, you know, is owned by Capcom. I can't send it to artists outside the studio. The only script I've got is this old Image pitch for this fantasy book called Skullkickers. I'll send it to you if you want to practice on it and just do portfolio pages." And I sent it to him. And a day or two later, he emailed me back and thought it was hilarious, thought it was really good. And he said, "I can't believe that no one's ever drawn this." And I said, "Well, actually, I had an artist. He's drawn some pages, and he's designed the characters. Like, it's all there. It already exists, but he wasn't able to continue." And he's like, "Oh, really? Well, can I pick up where he left off and just do the next page?" I'm like, "Well, sure." So he did. Like, he was still in school. I think this is the craziest part about it. So he was still working on his final art assignments for school, and he did two or three penciled pages of art, and they looked awesome, and they were totally in line with what Chris was doing, and they looked great. I actually sent them along to Joe Keating, and Joe Keating emailed me back almost instantly going, "Oh my God, Chris is drawing it again." And I was like, "This isn't Chris. This is some 21-year-old from New York. You know, he's amazing." And so he's like, you've got to get this kid to draw the book. I'm like, well, he's just using this to build his portfolio and get a real job. Like, I don't think I, you know, can crowbar him into drawing my book. And but I, the more stuff he sent me, the more excited I got. And I got thinking, I got to get this kid to do this book. And then he started inking the pages. And they were just looking phenomenal. And I was just trying to work up my courage to ask him to do the book. And then he emailed me and said, you know, I'd do this book if you want me to.
Nice.
And it was like, yes, actually, that's all I've been thinking about for like the last 2 days, man. you are the man. And we sort of went from there. But, you know, by the time this had all happened, Eric Stevenson was now the head publisher. And there was no guarantee that he was necessarily going to approve the book. I mean, it's in, you know, his right to, just because Larson said he liked it doesn't mean that Image has to carry it. There's a new publisher involved. So I really kind of hedged my bets. So we finished the entire first issue, colored, lettered, done, before I resubmitted it to Image. And then, you know, we've been off and running ever since. So that was, the book launched in September 2010. And we've had 12 issues since then, 2 trade paperbacks. And our third arc starts in April.
Nice.
Now, when you say you sort of you had to resubmit the Image, did you have the direct line to Eric Stevenson just through Larson, or what was that process?
Yeah, specifically? Yeah. So when Larson left his position, I think he sent out, if I recall correctly, he sent out like an email to all of his contact list, basically saying, "This is the guy now that you're going to be dealing with." And so yep. I was in on that email, so I had an email address to send it to, at least, you know. So I guess that's
pretty
handy. It's definitely my in for sure.
Yeah, because I did initially want to ask sort of how you went about pitching this, but it seems like Image came scalping for it, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, the Pop Gun was sort of our
trial.
Foot in the door. Yeah, it worked out really well. The tough thing for me was, you know, with the original Pop Gun stories are kind of fully painted, because that was how Chris was illustrating it, because he thought, oh, 10 pages, I'm going to, you know, go all like Richard Corbin crazy on this stuff. And then when we realized we're going to do a full book, he's like, I can't draw 22 pages of fully painted stuff. It'll kill me. So he kind of simplified the characters. But the great thing was they were really good designs. And so even as line art or as more simple kind of cartoony looking characters, they still worked really well. And in some ways, I actually think they work better. They're more expressive and more dynamic. So, but that's my animation background coming through, you know.
Yeah.
So this is something that we talked about recently, Jim. You've made a decision to take Skullkickers onto a website called keenspot.com. What's going on?
Ah, we're not supposed to talk about this yet. Yeah. Okay.
What? So we only have 130 listeners, so it's not going to be a big
deal. No, I'm not interested about it. So what's happened is it's been a really, I mean, let's be honest, the entire publishing industry is going through massive upheaval right now. So, you know, book publishers, comic book publishers, everyone's trying to figure out their digital strategy. You know, the music industry got its butt kicked by digital and got dragged into the 21st century, whether they liked it or not. And now with digital tablet devices taking off and with Kindle and everything else, the publishing industry is going through the same kind of shotgun marriage. And no one knows where it's going to end up. No one knows how it's going to work or what the end result's going to be. But everyone knows that the content, you know, is moving digital. That doesn't mean that print doesn't matter. That doesn't mean that print's not important. But if you don't have a digital strategy, or if you're not thinking about digital, you're going to be dead in the water. And so I was looking at, you know, our print sales are decent. Our trade sales are quite strong. But I was noticing that, you know, we were hitting a ceiling in terms of our readership. We weren't, you know, once you're up to issue 12, it's not like it used to be in comics where people would be happy to just grab any issue and get caught up. If you grabbed an issue of Amazing Spider-Man, you didn't care that it was issue number 200, whatever. You know, you didn't feel like, well, I can't start reading this till I get issue 1. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's a very different mentality nowadays, and people want to get the whole thing right from the start. And so I felt like it was becoming an impediment to us growing, that we were kind of hitting our ceiling. And so I did a bunch of research and I looked online, and the biggest comics in the world right now, you know, obviously there's manga, but the biggest comics in the world right now are online comics. You know, Penny Arcade has more readers than Justice League does.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, that's a huge, that is the world. The world is online. You know, the modern world is online. Okay. So where am I going to find more fantasy fans? Where am I going to find more people to read the book? Am I going to find it, you know, like by screaming and yelling and trying to get a retailer to carry three more copies of my book? Or am I going to find it online and then have those people go to the comic book store and request the book? And that was sort of the dilemma that I was left with when I looked at everything. And I said, look, you know, our book is being BitTorrented like crazy, and I don't mind saying it. You know, our stuff's being pirated to hell and back, and I can either let that continue and pretend that's not happening, or I can rage, and beat my chest and point fingers and tell everyone they're a dirty thief. Or I can try and, you know, grab the tiger by the tail and actually figure this thing out. And so here's sort of my thoughts and my strategy on it. We're going to serialize the content online. So one page every weekday, which sounds pretty fast, 5 pages a week. But essentially, you're going to get, it's going to take just over a month for us to serialize one complete issue of Skull Kickers. And I've got 12 issues in the can. So that's over a year's worth of content. If you want to read Skull Kickers for free at a you know, steady clip, but literally one page every weekday, you can go to my website and you can read it one page at a time. You know, or you can go back, read the archives, and get caught up to wherever we're at. I mean, we're currently, it only started, you know, on Monday. So we're up to page 3 of issue 1 plus our old short stories. So if you want to read Skull Kickers that way, and, you know, put it in your RSS reader or something like that, you're going to get a hit every day. And slowly but surely, I think we're going to hook you, because it's a good book and it's a fun book and it's a silly book and a humorous book and the characters are rich and the whole 10 yards. So if day by day I slowly break down your resolve, because you're reading it 5 right? And by the time we get to month 3 or month 4 and you've read 60 or 70 pages. Like if you're not a fan, well then I don't think you'll ever be a fan. Do you know what I mean? If you can read 80 pages of the thing and you're like, yeah, it's just not doing it for me. Like, I can't believe you read 80 pages of something that you don't think is that great, but okay, whatever. Like at the end of the day, I don't have you, right? But if there was any inkling of support, and if you think it's fun and if you think it's cool, every day when you go to that page, just below the comic, there's a little link there that says, buy it at your local comic shop. There's another link that says buy it on Amazon. And there's another link that says buy it on Comixology. So if you're reading issue 2 and you know that issue 13 just came out and you're like, I'm thoroughly enjoying this. It's really great. I wish there was more. Oh, wait, there is. There's like 10 more issues that I'm not even reading that I could read in an instant if I just click that little button. So I think it's just going to be a slow, steady advertisement for our books. And I think it's going to be viable in its own right, because there are, you know, the entire world's online and there are tons and tons of fantasy fans and there are tons and tons of gamers and there are tons of comic book readers. And so bit by bit, I'm going to hook you. That's kind of my strategy as far as it goes. On top of all that, you know, it's going to expand our online presence, so people are going to know who we are. It's going to allow us to advertise convention appearances to a bigger audience. And above and beyond all that, there's banners running on the site, so we get a little bit of ad revenue. So even if you never bought anything from me, but you read it every single day, you've dropped a couple pennies in the jar to help pay for new Skull Kickers. You put it all together, and I really don't see a downside to it.
I think it's a fantastically bold move, and digital is just such a big thing that really, as you say, isn't being explored yet, or at least not to complete potential. And yet I'm wondering, how much scope did Image give you to run with this idea, to take their a product that goes through them and start dishing it out for free?
Well, the funny thing is that I'm not the first Image comic to even do this. So the New Brighton Archaeological Society, which is done by Mark Andrew Smith, sorry, for Image. He's been serializing his story. He's up to over a page 100 now. I think he's at like page 108 or 109 went up today. So he's been serializing this thing for months online for free. And the Evangeline guys have been doing it for just over a month, and they've been serializing mm-hmm. online for free. Essentially, the Evangeline guys were the ones that introduced me to the Keenspot guys, and they really kind of tipped me over the edge because I was doing – I guess we're going to talk about Makeshift Miracle in a bit. But I was doing Makeshift Miracle, which is my webcomic that I'm doing right now. And the Evangeline guys were sort of inspired by Makeshift Miracle to serialize their stuff. So it's sort of this weird snake eating its own tail of inspiration. So they thought me serializing Makeshift was a great idea. So they decided they were going to serialize their earlier issues of Evangeline. They're up to like issue 7 or 8 right now. And they told me their stats, how they did after a month. And I was gobsmacked. I was just blown away. They were getting hundreds of thousands of page views within a month. And I thought, oh my God, this is craziness. And they're like, yep, our Amazon ranking's gone up and our Comixology sales are big.
Oh, nice.
Twitter followers are growing. And, you know, it's not hurting our sales at all, not on any conceivable level. It's just helping in every category. And so any kind of fear that I had at that point was just fell away. And I said, this is ridiculous. I mean, either I can sit there and I can, you know, get a Google alert that tells me that a torrent has been reseeded every few days and I can like, you know, want to claw my face off, or I can just go with the flow and see what happens. So
yeah, try to control the content more than just allow other people to control it on your, you know, sending it illegally on all these stupid torrents when you can have it on a site that has links where they can actually purchase it if they want.
Got it. And they can find out about us and they can get personally invested in the creators and what we're doing and the hard work we put into it. Like, you know, this is the thing, is that do I find online piracy frustrating? Sure. Can mm-hmm. I stop it? Like if DreamWorks and Paramount, all these, you know, record companies can't stop it, what the hell have I got in my arsenal? Nothing, right? So I can either smash my face into a wall, or I can, you know, try and figure out what's actually happening and go with where the media is going and try and understand it and grab a hold of it rather than just sort of spitting and you know, getting more bitter about it. And so to me, it just feels like it's not a losing proposition on any front. But it is an experiment. Like we've literally been doing this for only a few days, so I don't have data yet to back it up. And it's kind of funny because I've been emailing a bunch of creators. We've been talking about it offline, just on email. And they're all really curious. I think they're all sort of like, oh, you go be the experiment. We'll see how that works out for you. And if it works, then we'll all back you up, you know? And that's cool. I don't mind. I'm pretty used to kind of diving into certain things face first and seeing if it works. You know, I'll boldly, you know, dive out of jump out of the trenches and we'll see how this goes.
I mean, realistically, I mean, if you look at all the comics that are on the shelves, there's no one can buy them all. And I think with the general comic audience, some of them want to branch out and some of them want to try different things and some of them are curious and you're going to hook a lot of those. Some of them are tight asses and you probably were never going to get them. And I think that's possibly a good write-off for the site to just say, if they were going to come here and read it for free, well, they were probably going to pirate. Maybe they were never going to buy it. And if that's a percentage that you can ignore, perhaps that'll work. But then there'll be a percentage that some people are real collectors and they want to have stuff on the shelves and they'll read that. And it'll force them to buy it. Or if they like it and they know people that are friends that would like it that won't have the patience to watch it serialized, they'll buy it as presents. So hopefully, and I'm sure data will show that, it'll prop things up in the long run, but it does. Sure. It takes you being it's very bold to just put your hard work, stuff that you realistically and rightfully expect to be paid for, out there for free.
Yeah, so, I mean, we're doing it in
and I think you will
format.
Be. You'll be the guinea pig that everybody else will be monitoring the heartbeat and wanting to see how it goes.
Yeah, but here's, you know, Neil Gaiman had this really fascinating video where he was talking about, you know, online piracy and readership and things like that. And one of the things he said there really struck a chord with me. And he said, okay, think very carefully about your absolute favorite authors, your favorite books, your favorite content, right? How many of those things did you come to whole cloth on your own? Just you saw a book on a shelf and you said, that looks interesting, and you bought it. And how many of those things did you come to because someone else recommended it to you?
Yeah. Right.
right? Like, it's pretty rare that you go into a store and you go, I'm looking for something interesting, and you randomly browse the shelf and go, that cover looks good, and you buy that thing. I mean, that's not generally the way a lot of us work with our media. We'll say, hey, do you know, you go to the comic book store and you say, what's good? And they'll say, oh, well, this, or if you like this book, you'll like that. Or they'll say, you know, oh, if you're reading this, then you should read that. Or literally some random dude who's in the store will just pipe up and tell you what they think. I mean, that's the comic book community, right? But, or if you're talking to your friends and you're like, oh, did you go see a movie on the weekend? Yeah, I really liked it or I hated it. There's that recommendation circle of the people you trust, of the content that you trust, right? And so in a sense, what I'm sort of saying is this is like the Skull Kickers lending library for people to get their taste of it and to read it and decide if they like it. And sort of like what you said, if you read, you know, 24 pages of it and you go, this is crap, well, then I never had you. You were never going to be one of my customers anyways, right? But if you read that and you had no interest before, but because you clicked through two links, you go, oh, this is interesting. Now there's even the chance that you could become a customer. Then that's a positive, you know, as far as I'm concerned.
And I think another sort of head to that hydra is social media. And for comics especially, I find that Twitter seems to be such a good way of you yourself perhaps disseminating information, but hopefully other people also spreading the good cheer. And I know, I mean, Skull Kickers seem to have a pretty big push behind it before the first issue had dropped. And I'm sure some of that had come from the short stories that had come previously, but how much of a hand did you have in really proliferating the love for the book as it was debuting?
Well, I did a lot of outreach and marketing stuff. So I knew from the get-go that we were, you know, I've been working with the Udon guys for a while and I've been peripherally involved in the comic book industry. So I kind of knew that the odds are, you know, that there are a lot of creator-owned books and most of them don't make enough to keep going. And so I really pushed hard and I had a pretty aggressive campaign, and that sounds kind of corny to say campaign, but I really did. Like, I think one of the misinterpretations that a lot of people have about marketing their work is that they assume that if they, the old adage of, you know, if you build it, they will come, right? So they say, I'm going to make this great thing, and then everyone will tell me how great it is. And the reality is, in this media saturated world, you've got to speak up. You've got to let people know that you're passionate about what you're doing, and you've got to get them intrigued. And so before we had the first issue out, the good thing was we had it done. You know, we were at three issues in the can before issue one came out. And so I knew we had content that I could leverage and get people interested in. So I started targeting websites, obviously all the big comic book news sites, but even lesser review sites that focused on horror or fantasy. I targeted a lot of those sites. I targeted sites that were just into pop culture stuff. And I looked for specific names of people that covered content that would be in line with Skull Kickers. And then I sent them. I had a boilerplate email that had all the details on the series, but the introductory paragraph I would always type up fresh and then said, hey, I noticed that your website talks about this stuff, or I noticed you wrote an article about this movie or these things. I think my book will be a good fit for this kind of stuff. Would you like to read the first two issues, you know, 3 months in advance? And just slowly but surely, essentially from scratch, built a mailing list of people who were reading the book ahead of time, who were talking about the book, who were interested in the book, because I had put out a hand and said, I'm doing this. And then when they responded, I added them to a mailing list where they would get to read the issues in advance, or they would get to ask me questions or do an interview or whatever. And, you know, those are the first line of communication. That's the first thing that most people heard was, you've never heard of Skull Kickers before, but you will, and it's good, and it's fun, and it's coming out. And so we sort of had this first layer of positive feedback that was going out into the world, and we sort of built off of that. And then it sort of hit a zeitgeist where we got covered by Ain't It Cool News and Bleeding Cool on the same day. And it just went nuts. It was really, really good. You know, our first issue sold out the day it was released. And we kind of rode that to three printings of the first issue and a bunch of really good press. And, you know, sort of came out of the gate really strong. And that was, it was, you know, it was huge. It was just an amazing sort of feeling that we had worked really hard and that I had pushed really hard, and people were responding well to it. So that's the long rambling answer to your question. Did you do a lot of, yes.
Well, you know, I've started to really recognize the importance of having that mailing list, because I mean, Image does have, you know, they do have their, a list of contacts that they send out all the preview stuff for, but I mean, you got to keep in mind, a lot of these people, a lot of these websites are just getting tons of stuff sent to them. You're getting, your stuff is getting tossed into the rest of the slush pile. But if you build up that rapport with certain reviewers and websites or actual contacts rather than like, you know, info@comicbuzz.com, if you actually have a name that you can send to, that there's something to be said about that, because they are much more, there's more of that connection. It's like, oh, the writer's sending that to me and he knows who I am, and we've had email conversations before and I've done an interview with them. And there, it's really, really important for, as an independent creator, to make those connections yourself and not, like you said, just expect people to come and figure out, you know, hear about your book. And I definitely noticed that, especially with Peter Panzerfaust. I thought, oh, this book is going to sell itself. And so I kind of rested on my laurels a little bit with that book. And when we got our pre-order numbers, I was like, oh, I better do some promotion for this book.
No, you really do. It makes a huge difference nowadays. You've got to be stumping for it. You know, no one's going to be as passionate about your stuff as you are. And so you've got to be visible and you've got to be out there. And retailers notice it and reviewers notice it and they'll get behind you. You know, you get kind of your own we're all underdogs. Like, we're all trying to figure this stuff out and get our ideas out there. And if you're visible and you're passionate and you're genuine, then it's going to make a huge difference in their minds about what they think, you know. And I think you've got to be, yeah, you've got to be out there. And so you try and strike this balance between, you know, you want to constantly be telling people, hey, buy the thing. But you also just want to be approachable and be cool at the same time. You know, underneath the surface, yeah, we're all neurotic about orders. We're all neurotic about the size of our audience or, you know, our success or whatever you want to call it. But, okay, after that falls away, you also just want to be like, hey, you know what? I'm making this thing. I'm putting my all into it. And I hope you like it, you know. And that's – it makes a huge difference. You can't – you know, it would be very, very difficult nowadays to kind of just create something and walk away from it and then go, well, I'm sure it'll be a success. I just, you know, this, the modern media doesn't allow for it, you know? And so, for better or for worse, you've got to be part of the marketing process. And like Curtis was saying, you know, Image is a great company and they've been awesome to work with, but they're also putting out like 40 titles or more a month. And, you know, only a handful of those titles are really, really financially supporting the company. So, you know, as much as I appreciate that they support what we do, understandably, something like The Walking Dead or Spawn is way more their priority than me. And I can't blame them at all for that. I'm not going to be bitter about that. That's reality. That's financial, you know, truth. And so I'm going to have to pick up the slack and do the rest of that myself, you know?
Yeah, that's totally true. That's definitely something I've learned in the last year. I can agree.
I was interested, Jim, with I can't remember if it was issue 5 or 6, but it was after the first arc. You had sort of like a jam issue with an anthology of sorts of different creators doing different stories. What was the thought process behind putting that together?
Yeah, that was a really weird thing. What happened was our story arc was 5 issues, and sort of the classic comic story arc seems to be 6 issues. And, you know, there was this sort of weird number in my head, like, we're going to ship 6 issues in 6 months and we're going to impress people that we're always on time and everything else. But we didn't have 6 issues. And I realized we were going to need a break in order to do our second arc and get it a buffer done ahead of time, because it was taking us more than a month to put together an issue. So even though we had 3 in the can when we started, we were going to eat up that buffer of material. So by the time we finished the arc, we'd pretty much be, you know, neck and neck. And so I thought, man, I need a 6th issue, and I also need a way to push back the deadlines, but I still want to be on the stands. I want to be visible in that crucial time where we're trying to build our audience. And so I had talked to some friends about, you know, the concept. Skull Kickers is such an open concept. These two guys kill monsters in funny ways, and it's this fantasy world where kind of anything goes. And some of my friends and people I respect in the industry said, oh yeah, man, I'd go nuts with that. I was like, great, do you want to go nuts with that? Do you want to do a short story? So I gathered some friends whose work I really love, and I actually contacted a couple people who I thought were very, very funny. Brian Clevinger, the guy that writes Atomic Robo. I think Atomic Robo is one of the best comics on the stands. I think it is accessible. I think it's funny. I think it's adventurous. It doesn't pander to its audience. It's all ages, but not in that like kiddified kind of way. It's smart and it's sassy and it's like the perfect adventure book. And so I've had a lot of respect for Brian for years, and I kind of knew him through other project stuff that Udon had done. We'd never worked with him, but he'd actually approached us when we were doing a comic book for this role-playing game called Exalted. And so I had this email from him from 2006 where he said, I'm the biggest Exalted fan ever, and if you guys ever need someone to write a short story or something, I would do it in a heartbeat. And this is long before Atomic Robo.
Really?
Yep. And so wow. I remembered this email, Christ. And I checked, and I'm like, it is the same guy. Holy crap, that's the Atomic Robo guy. And so I responded to that email in 2011.
That's amazing.
And I said, hey, Brian, since you sent this email, I have done all these different things, and now I'm doing my own comic at Image called Skull Kickers, and you are a comic book superstar who's writing Atomic Robo and has all this awesome stuff under your belt. Hi. How's it going? I'm a huge fan, and I feel like, you know, I didn't have any control over the way the Exalted stuff worked, and I couldn't hire you to be a writer on that because that wasn't my project. But I'm in charge of this, and I would love to get some sort of weird karmic balance by offering you a short story. Would you be interested? And he emailed me back like an hour later and said it would be his pleasure.
Wow.
And we've been friends ever since. Adam Warren is a friend of the Udon studio, and I've loved his work for years and years and years, and I think he's a very funny writer. And so I enticed him to come write a short story. And Ray Fox, who normally does very serious comics, like he did a comic that's getting a lot of attention called One Soul, and he did a Vertigo series called Nemovore. But I know him as a friend, and he's a very, very funny guy. And I said, I know you're hilarious. I want you to write a comedy thing for me. And so he jumped on board to do that. And it was just a really cool thing to be able to call up someone and say, I want you to do your thing with my characters and have fun. And we put out the issue. I was a little nervous that people were going to hate it, but they actually loved it. And it brought in a lot of people who wouldn't normally, I think, have picked up the book. And so now we've kind of made it a tradition. So we're going to do 5-issue story arcs, and then the 6th issue will always be what we call Tavern Tales, which is this jam issue of creators I respect and people I want to work with and fun stuff that kind of throws people off. So we did in issue 12, we did another Tavern Tales, and it was filled with awesome creators and another, you know, fun jam out with people I've always wanted to work with. So
I think it's a good idea for the comic buying public, because it'll lure in a few other heads and it'll lure in fans of these other writers. But I like that you can be so open and just sort of say, hey guys, here's my characters and world, have a bit of a play. I think that's pretty loose.
Well, the nice thing about Skull Kickers is the concept is comical and ridiculous. And so, you know, I don't feel like we've got a lot of open territory to explore there. You know, every so often, like I've done a couple edits where I've said, okay, let's adjust the dialogue a bit, so the cadence sounds a little more like the characters. But, you know, and they're pitching me the concept, so I make sure that it's not going to tromp on ideas that I have coming up or things like that. But overall, you know, it is pretty open-ended, and that's the beauty of the world that we're working with. And these characters is that they're pretty easy to work with as concepts. And, you know, if it's violent and ridiculous and funny, it's going to work in some capacity. So we've got, even though the next Tavern Tales issue isn't coming out for many months to come, we're already sort of planning. I've been approached by some people who specifically asked if they could do one, and that I was kind of blown away about. And we've got a couple of surprises up our sleeves in terms of that. So the first announcement about Tavern Tales and what we've got coming up is going to be at Image Expo next month. So I'm pretty jazzed about that.
Cool.
Nice.
Looking forward, how much more of the title do you sort of have planned tightly or loosely?
I know exactly where the story's going in terms of an ending, and we're layering in a whole bunch of subplot stuff right from the get-go, we've been putting elements in there that are going to pay off later on. And the idea was, if it was just a mini series, then it wouldn't matter. You wouldn't notice the stuff, and it wouldn't matter. But now that it's, you know, longer, a lot of this stuff that we've been sort of injecting into it secretly is going to start to bubble up to the surface. And I think people are going to be surprised, especially in the third arc, when we start pulling out the whammies, as I call them, like some of the little secrets and some of the things that look like they're chaotic and they look random, but they're actually going to start tying together in funny ways. And people are going to realize that there's actually a little more structure involved than they might have previously. So I've sort of got like the master plan, and then I've got alternate plans. So I know if we had to do the short version, I could wrap up the whole thing in 4 story arcs. And so we'd get four softcover trade paperbacks, and we'd get 2 hardcover books. And that would be really cool. And I have a way that we could do it in 6 story arcs, so that we'd have a trilogy of hardbacks when we're all done and 6 nice soft covers. And I have another one that would be like our epic, amazing. I get to tromp on every single fantasy story that I've ever wanted to make fun of, or every single cliche. And so you'll notice with the book, we keep dragging the characters from location to location. So the first adventure is like just rampant action and crazy. And the second one is all about sort of the urban, like it's all about these fairy folk, but it's also about this city. And sort of we've got the Thieves Guild, and we've got these plant monsters and all that stuff. And our third arc is all about pirates and sea monsters. And it's playing on all those kind of medieval fantasy cliches. And then I've got future ideas for like a desert expedition, or like, you know, Vikings of the Norse, and like jungle exploration, like every fantasy cliche I would love for these idiots to tromp their way through eventually. So the more arcs we get to play with, the more environments and the more places we get to chuck them, and slowly but surely reveal how these things all tie together and why, and what it means to be like, I, you know, every big epic fantasy story is usually this heroes of destiny and the item of destiny, or the, you know, like the Lord of the Rings and all that stuff. And the whole point of Skull Kickers, if we had to sum it all up, is to skewer those things directly in the heart. It's like a love letter that hurts. Like, we're going to go, look at this stuff. You love it, and it's stupid, and you love it, and we love it, but it's stupid. And we just sort of run wild with it. And we're going to tell the anti-hero version of the heroes of destiny, if you will.
That's nice. Pretty cool.
One of the things that we like to talk about here when we have guests on, and a lot of people find it very interesting, is what your process is actually like when you go to write down a script. We did touch on it briefly. Why don't you talk about kind of how you write your scripts and what kind of environment you set yourself up in order to be most effective when it comes to writing?
Sure. Okay. Writing for me it's weird. The actual scripting process I don't find to be too bad. The planning process is where I spend most of my sweat. So I break down the story arc into major and minor scenes. So what I'll do is it's almost like I forget which writer there was. There's a movie script writer who said in any movie, 30 things have to happen. Some of them are important and some of them are less important, but 30 things have to happen. So I don't say 30 things, but I write down a list of all the things I want to have happen in an arc. So these are scenes that come to mind, or big action moments, or revelations that have to happen, or character progression that has to take place in order for this story to complete itself. And then I start breaking them down and sort of saying which ones have to happen before the other ones. So this can't happen until they find this out. They can't go here until they know to go there. Do you know what I mean? Like sort of breaking down motivations or what the order of the dominoes that have to fall in order for these things to take place. And then I'll try and structure them into chapters. So does this chapter have a punchy opening? Does it have a catchy ending, cliffhanger style thing? If not, how can I rejig it, or what other elements can I inject into it to give it a little bit more heft, more interest, more fun, more punch to our kick, you know? So it's like, and then once I've got that structurally built, I break down each issue into, you know, I literally have a text file and I go from 1 to 22 or from 1 to 20 or whatever the page count is going to be. And I'll write down a sentence that encompasses that page. So in my mind, when you're reading a page, what is the thing you'll remember most about this page, or what is the important thing that has to happen? If there's no purpose for this page, why is it in the book? Do you know what I mean? And sometimes that purpose can be violence happens. Like, because it's an action book, a certain percentage of the book should be these guys kick the shit out of stuff. Like, that's a totally viable thing in an action book, right? But it has to have purpose. So I'm not just doing filler pages where I'm just gliding along without purpose, or dialogue without focus. And so now that I know what needs to happen on every page, or what needs to happen in every issue, I can start jamming funny dialogue, or I can start coming up with the banter, or I can start coming up with the weird turns of a phrase, or the things that are going to make it all come together. So by the time I'm at that point, I'm literally scripting. And sometimes I can organically make a scene longer or shorter than I'd originally planned. But if I ever lose my focus, I just go back to that pacing sheet and I go, what needs to happen? What is happening on this page? Why am I here? You know what I mean? And that keeps me focused. And it, so once I hit the scripting process, it can go pretty quick. The fastest I've ever scripted an issue is probably issue 5, because that was the end of our first arc. And it was literally just tying up every string that we had set in motion. Like every little thread that we had started in the story, we were going to tie off all of them. And so I knew everything that was coming. I'd been planning for it the whole time, and I had it really clearly visualized in my head. So I wrote the whole script in one day. I just woke up in the morning and just hacked it, and I was like halfway done, and it was lunchtime. And I went, holy crap, I should take a break. And so I had lunch, and then I thought, I really want to finish this. I'll just see how far I can go. And I just rammed right through the rest of it. And I still think it's one of our better issues, just because it was all about pushing the button on all these things that we had set into motion, you know?
That's pretty awesome when that can happen, when you can write something in a full day. I've had it happen to me once or twice, and yeah, it's if you can just get that bug, it's one of the most frustrating things I find as part of my process, is feeling like I'm not getting enough writing done, especially now that it's my full-time job. I'm the harshest critic of my own productivity, you know?
Oh, sure. Well, and this is the tough thing. And so, you know, I've used the same writing process for Makeshift Miracle, and I've used it for work for hire stuff I've done. And it works. it seems to work across the board. It's a little harder sometimes when it's someone else's characters and you're trying to find the voice for it. Or it's a little tougher when, you know, I can't just inject another action scene to keep the story going. Like the Skull Kickers, I've got the benefit of, well, if I don't know what to do, you know, someone's going to throw a punch. Like, okay, let's just keep it going, keep it violent, keep it fun. You know, when you're doing something that's more character sensitive, you know, you've got to justify scenes even more so. But yeah, that's sort of my working process on it. And it's funny because when people read the book, I think they get the idea that it's all chaotic and it's a roller coaster ride and you never know what's going to come next. So I think they assume that I'm just like being stupid, like just coming up with dumb things and then jamming it out and not knowing where I'm going. And I guess that it's sort of a weird compliment in the sense that they think that I just doing this on the fly, but I'm actually way more controlled and organized than they may expect. So,
how do you set yourself up when you go to write? Where do you work from home? Do you go to like an office or music? What's it like?
I've written everywhere. I usually write in my office. I've got a little laptop there and I'll just pound away at it. I don't have a particular, you can get into a writing zen for sure. And it's easier when you're not being distracted, but I've written, I teach at an art college, in Toronto. So I've written on my lunch break, or I've written in between classes, or I've written in the evening, I've written in the morning. I don't sort of have a pattern for it. I tend to have productivity where if I get rolling, I don't want to be bugged because I'm on a roll. But I don't really have a particular place or a particular thing. You know, it's more a matter of I don't put on particular music or stuff like that per se. The most important thing for me is like turning off Thunderbird so I don't get bombarded with emails and, you know, just pound at it, you know, until with Skull Kickers, it's usually the first chunk of writing is not very funny. Like I'm more technical, And then when I'll get on a roll and I'll start sort of chuckling and coming up with good turns of a phrase or a funny way of playing out an action sequence, then I'll go back and I'll revise some of the drier stuff with the energy that I've built up off of a good scene. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah. Interesting.
I think that's a really interesting concept to look at. You got to get into your flow and then go back and sort of fix up what was maybe sort of a dry run or you building up.
Yeah, or sometimes I'll get pencils from Edwin and I'll realize that his posing is a little more constrained because my description of that scene was more constrained, and then I'll be like, oh no, man, no, this is supposed to be wild. This is supposed to be nuts. I need you to go further. And so then sometimes I'll make revisions even in the art stage a little bit. There was a scene that I'm writing in issue 13 where there's a food fight. And it's just like, how maniacal can we make this food fight? What can we do? And so I just kept piling stuff on. And then there was just this one little sequence where I realized Edwin sent me artwork and it was really subdued. And I read the panel. I was like, oh man, that does sound really dry. Yeah, no. What I meant was this should be like practically Looney Tunes, like stuff's going nuts at this point, you know. So you can, the nice thing about collaborating with other people is you get a second chance.
Yeah.
Well, we're kind of coming out to the end of the show. You briefly mentioned it. I mentioned it at the beginning, you mentioned it a few times during the show. So we'll tie this into our kind of our last question of what is coming from you in 2012. But why don't you briefly touch on Makeshift Miracle first?
Sure. So Makeshift Miracle is sort of like there's nothing sort of about it. It's my new story concept. That's also my old story concept. So the very first comic that I ever wrote was back in 2001, and it was the Makeshift Miracle, and I serialized it online from 2001 to 2003. According to Scott McCloud, it's one of the first complete graphic novels ever serialized online, which is kind of funky. And So when we were coming up on the 10th anniversary, just a good series of not coincidences, but things sort of came about. My boss at Udon, Eric, was over in China, in Hong Kong, and he was introduced to an artist named Shunhong Chan. And the guy had this beautiful, beautiful watercolor artwork, just unbelievable. And Eric was like, I love this guy's stuff. I really want to work with him on a project, but I don't really have anything in mind. And he brought the samples back and showed me, and I was just blown away by them. And so Eric and I started talking about a possible project. What could we do with this guy? We got to put together a story or something like that. And Eric mentioned a couple times when we were talking, he says, you know, something really sensitive and kind of like cool and moody, you know, like Makeshift Miracle, like you did, you know, that kind of a story. And three or four times it came up in conversation, you know, something sort of like Makeshift Miracle. And I said, yeah, I should do something like that. And I kept trying to pound out some different ideas. And then I thought to myself, man, when I relook at that story, I really like some – I like a – you know, in general, but I was a really raw writer back then. I didn't know what I was doing. I would do so much more with that concept now. I would take it so much further. I would build something so much bigger. Wouldn't that be cool? And so that ended up becoming the discussion, which is now the thing. So we relaunched Makeshift Miracle in September, which was on the 10th anniversary of the original, and we're serializing it online. And Udon is committed to do two books. The first one comes out in May, and we've been pounding away on it for a year in February. I actually started writing it again in February of last year so that we'd have a huge buffer of material in time for September. So while people right now online are reading chapter 3, I'm working on chapter 9.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been awesome. And so we're going to have two books for sure, and then if it does well, like two full graphic novels. And then if it does well, you know, I know where I would take it further if I had the chance. So it's really gratifying. It's wonderful seeing the visuals that are coming in and just, you know, building up a much stronger emotional base for the story. It's been a thrill.
How's the response been so far?
It's been good. It's been really cool. It's weird because a whole lot of people that read it back in 2001, 2002 have sort of come out of the woodwork and been like, oh, my God, I remember that. You know, and they're kind of getting back on board, but then there's a whole other audience, you know, that has never seen this stuff before. And to them, it's a whole new experience. We're going to do some twists and turns to the story that even if you knew the original, you're not going to quite see where it's going. Like there's going to be some new stuff in there for sure. And a bigger, mythology to this, to the way it's built. But, But yeah, it's been really cool. And it's funny too, because a lot of people, I think they got in their head, they typecast me after Skull Kickers that I'm the guy that does goofy action and, you know, weird onomatopoeia, you know, for sound effects. But Makeshift's really subdued, and it's much slower, and it's much more emotional. And it's got this structure that's much more like almost like a dramatic manga, where they'll tend to hang on a particular scene for a long time, and they'll really build up an atmosphere, and then they'll pay off an important moment, and then they'll think about, and they'll sort of come down from it and be looking back at that moment, and what does that mean, and what happens now, and then they build up for another big moment. And so it's a very different style of writing, and it's a very different style of pacing. And it's been a really cool challenge switching gears and writing a very different story, you know, than sort of the bombastic bloodbath of Skull Kickers.
I'm just I'm on the site now. This guy's art is unbelievable.
He's unbelievable. He's crazy. it's what's amazing is he doesn't speak English, so all the scripts get translated into Chinese.
Oh wow! Oh,
shit.
So I at first I was really worried about it, where I was writing. The first chapter was written really normal, like my normal format. And then I realized, oh man, I'm using all these colloquialisms, and is this going to come across? But thankfully we've got a translator who's phenomenal, and she's done a great job at, like, she knows how to bring that across in Chinese and basically explain to him, this is the attitude, or this is, you know, Jim's making this weird aside to this thing. Here's the reference material. This is what it entails. So the translator's doing some real heavy lifting on that. And I'm able to just write freely without fear, which is kind of awesome.
That's great. So what else do you have coming up in 2012? I've touched on a few things.
I've got a couple work for hire projects that haven't been announced yet, which I'm pretty excited about. I put in some pitches for a couple other work for hire projects that I'm waiting to hear on. And I've got a new a graphic novel that I'm working on. It's an all ages graphic novel. Specifically, though, it's basically like an adventure story for young girls that I'm super, super excited about. And I've pitched out to different publishers. And
You showed that one in Toronto, didn't you?
Yep.
Oh, yeah, that's glorious.
So the pitch is finished, and we've got 6 full finished pages colored and lettered that I sent out to book publishers. And the response has been good, and we're starting to talk about the possibilities. So with this kind of – with the traditional publishing industry, it can take a while. And so I'm trying not to be neurotic about it. You know, comics can get you really you get used to the quick turnaround where, you know, you're soliciting it and 3 months later it's on the stands. Or with web stuff, you just post it, you know. And with traditional publishing and with the larger companies, you know, you're going to wait months and then you're going to talk. And then you're going to, you know, set up a conference call and then you're going to talk. And then you just got to kind of get into a zen-like state where you just go, it'll happen if it's meant to happen. You know, we put together a good pitch. I'm confident in what it is, so we'll just see how it all goes. And that's kind of where we're at right now.
So you mentioned that there's quite a few places that have it, so clearly you're not just sticking with Image. You're trying a bunch of different avenues now.
Yeah, here's the way I looked at it is I said, you know, I'm curious. I think it would find a really good home at Image. I think that you know, Image is publishing such a diverse slate of books that it could fit there quite well. But I'm curious what other, you know, I don't want to close off any avenues until I hear from other people about what they think or you know, what their kind of concept would be with it. And if I can find the synchronicity that I want, then I'm willing to go with it. I don't want to sound cocky like, oh, yeah, I'm sure we're going to get, you know, some huge release or anything. I just want to find the right home for the project, and I'm willing to be patient about it. And so I think that's going to serve us better in the long run.
Nice.
It's a great mindset, Jim. And I guess that'll wrap us up. And I personally wanted to say thanks for the chat, man. It was a real honor to have you on the show.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. You know, it's an honor to be here. And I really hope, you know, your own creative projects. It's awesome hearing from you guys about what you're working on and sort of your mindset on this stuff. It's awesome. I can empathize completely, you know. And as confident as I sound about some of this stuff, you know, I think we all have the same neuroses about what we're doing and how we're doing it and how quickly it's coming along. So, you know, take heart, man, and just keep plugging away on everything. And I hope you guys have a lot of success in 2012.
That's the plan. Hopefully we'll keep documenting it here. And I mean, yeah, we get a lot of good feedback, and it's from a lot of writers, which is, I mean, that's what the podcast's about. And I'm glad we found that fan base with, I'm really shocked at how many image writers check out the show. And obviously Kurt is a bit of a hook there, and we'll drag the eyes in, but it's nice to see people, you know, sending in emails and saying good day to us and letting us know that, you know, they know exactly what we're feeling, which is, I mean, if somebody looks at you, Jim, and they see this, the wild success of Skull Kickers, and they hear the confidence, they'll think, oh, that's worlds away. But it's really nice to hear you sort of break it down and put it on a very open level. You've been really candid, which is appreciated.
Thanks, man. No problem. Well, if people want to check out the stuff, if they, you know, obviously they can go to skullkickers.com. That's sort of our main blog. Or now online, they can go to no www. It's just skullkickers.keenspot.com, which is serializing now 5 days a week. Makeshift Miracle runs at makeshiftmiracle.com. And I'm on Twitter as Jim Zub, so JimZub. And feel free to drop me a line, say hi if you like the podcast or just want to stay in touch.
Cool. All right. Well, I guess we'll wrap up. And yeah, thanks again, Jim. And we will, again, as usual, have just as many pretty cool guests coming up in the near future. And we will talk to everyone very soon.